Here at Physio Matters, we think physio matters. Become a member today and access over 500 webinars, get free tickets to shows, and access new content instantly. Access at home, work, or on the train to make sure your CPD is on track. Physio-matters.com, more content than the all-you-can-eat buffet cart.
Hello and welcome to You Matter. Hello and welcome to session 39 of You Matter, nearly big birthday time for You Matter. And in this episode, I am talking to someone that I have been looking forward to speaking to in more depth for ages. And I'm so pleased that finally Tom, Jessen and I have managed to get over time zones and diaries to record this episode, which is the next in the series of Clinician And. And I approached Tom to talk about being a clinician and a writer, which is the subject of most of the podcast. But as with most You Matter episodes, we find lots of other very exciting rabbit holes to dive down. I love this conversation with Tom, and I think it's one that you're going to enjoy as well. So sit back, enjoy the meandering, enjoy the rabbit holes, and I will be back to chat to you at the end. So hello and welcome to this latest edition of You Matter, where my guest on this episode is Tom Jessen. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jo. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on. So Tom probably doesn't need much introduction from many of you, but if you need it, Tom was originally an MSK clinician, and he just told me actually that one of his favourite jobs was in a GP clinic in Newcastle, specifically Gateshead, which apparently needs to be said or people will get cross. And he spent 6 months also in a pain clinic. But Tom now lives in Houston, Texas. He's been there for the last 3 years, and we'll talk a little bit more about what brought Tom to the States. Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for making the time, and particularly with the time difference, it's taken us a little while to tee this up, hasn't it?
Yeah, there's a little window where it's kind of convenient for both of us, and glad we managed to find it. Yeah.
So actually, Tom, we could talk about anything, because I know that you and I have both had lots of feedback about our voice and how we put people to sleep and how we sound so lovely and will we read bedtime stories and things like that. So we could just talk about anything, really, apparently.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you see, there's like the phone book is to hand, and then we can just read that. This is like the perils of doing anything in public. I never felt self-conscious about my voice at all until someone told me. Someone said, oh, you sound like Sam Harris. You know Sam Harris?
He's a podcast. I don't know Sam Harris.
Okay. He's not such a big thing anymore, but someone said that, and ever since. It's a new thing to know about myself, I suppose.
Yeah. I know what you mean, though. As soon as someone says it's good, you're like, ooh, well, what if today it's not good? And which bit is good? Should I emphasize this bit or that bit?
Well, it's equivocal praise, because the thing people say is, oh, it's very like soporific, like it makes me feel sleepy. I'm like, that surely isn't something you really want in a voice. I'd rather hear like, oh, it's stirring, or like I think it's good for reading bedtime stories to the kids. I feel like that's where it really comes into its own.
Yeah, and particularly the second half of the podcast, if everyone's asleep, then it doesn't matter what we say. All right, so in all seriousness, what did take you to Texas?
Family. So I'm married an American. That's a really short version. Yeah, this is where I have to kind of, I'm used to not talking about this stuff on podcasts, but that's the whole point, isn't it? You're not going to ask me what's the difference between radicular pain and referred pain. So I'm out of my comfort zone now.
Yeah, but not that I'm not interested, but today I'm not interested.
But you have to promise me that, to tell me if you're not interested in stuff that I say, because my natural like filter is, don't tell people about this stuff. Why does anyone care? But so you have to tell me. But I'm married an American. That's the short version. So my wife's from California.
Yeah.
We met 12 years, a bit more ago in South Korea. We were both working in South Korea as English teachers, which is like, I don't know people how common that is anymore, but like at the time that was kind of a lot of people. You didn't quite know what to do when you graduated, you teach English.
No, that's still a thing. My daughter's about to do a TEFL course. for probably the same reason.
Well, there you go. And so it was one of the best things I did because obviously it gets you out of your environment a little bit. And I met her. She's from California. After a little while in South Korea, we went our separate. We stayed together, but we went our separate ways physically, so she could continue her training. She's a neuropsychologist, and so I could do my training as a physio. And then we got back together, and when we got married in Michigan,
Okay.
4 or 5 years ago now, I think. Yeah, I'm terrible with
So,
dates. That's it.
is the plan to stay long term?
Yes, yeah, all in now on America. Yeah, citizenship. I can apply for citizenship, I think, next year. I should, yeah, this year actually, I can apply for citizenship. Both of the children were born in Texas, and there's always the option, I suppose, to go to England if we ever need to. The ins and outs of immigration would make that very difficult. It's not something we could do casually,
Right.
but we're definitely all in America here, and her, she's really established in her career, so that's. And the facilities we have here as a family are really good in Houston. It's,
So there you are. I'm educated already, Tom, because for some reason, and this is clearly what I've made up in my own head, your wife was English. I knew she was a doctor. You'd gone over because she had to do some training in America and you were going back in a few years. So isn't it incredible how that was fact as far as I was concerned? God knows
That's
where that came
fine.
from. So it's really interesting that you say, I'm not sure why people are interested. And it's a really good point. And it's kind of the point that I'm doing this series of clinician and. The short answer would be that I'm interested and I'm very nosy about people. But I think the reason it probably has been popular and is proving to be really popular is that I think the clinician identity is quite a strong one that we take on. I often tell the story of driving home from when I'd finished work for my first maternity leave. And just, I distinctly remember driving under this particular bridge on the M5 going north from Bristol to Gloucester, going, oh shit, I'm not a physio for the next, it was only 6 months then. So who am I? And that now looking back, I'd only been qualified less than 10 years then, but I really felt it strongly. It's so much of who I am. And that wasn't true then, and it isn't true now, but I think also we spend clinically our lives extracting all sorts of information from other people. And maybe that is the reason that we're interested in each other beyond the clinical face. So yeah, I don't know if that is the answer or not, but it seems to be a popular series. And there'll be lots of ands for you, Tom, but the one that I've picked up on is clinician and writer, which I know is a huge part of your life now. Do you want to tell us a bit of how that all started?
I think it was it started sort of casually or by accident. Like it was never, and that's kind of one of the things when sometimes people contact me and say, like, oh, how can you, I start doing this stuff? That's a diversion already. But then I say, well, I didn't really start deliberately. You kind of have to, it sounds so corny, but it kind of has to happen somewhat naturally that you become interested in something. And the best way to express it or progress that interest is to write about it or podcast about it. Excuse me. So it was fairly soon after graduation. I was given one of those really simple sort of tasks as a new grad, which is a long time ago now, it feels like it. And it was, what's the difference between sciatica radicular pain, referred pain radiculopathy. And after researching it, I put out a little Twitter thread, and that was quite popular. It turned out a lot of people didn't actually know that. And one of the interesting things about writing or kind of researching is a lot of people secretly don't know a lot of stuff that they kind of operate with day to day, or they know it superficially or just well enough to get through their day. So to take that example again, they might write referred pain when they mean radicular pain because they're not quite sure. And that's not a criticism. That's just once you kind of get your eye in, there's so much stuff in life where you just kind of get through it. Like, I don't really know how my car works. I drive it every day and that kind of thing. So it turns out there's quite like a rich seam of stuff to mine there in MSK in general, but especially when it comes to like radicular pain of stuff actually people kind of knew about, say, disc herniations, but actually don't. And also there's just like a huge amount of interesting literature going back like 100, 200 years to read and kind of sift through. So it all happened quite naturally that it just felt like, oh, I'll read and then I'll write it up. I'll read and then I'll write it up. Then during COVID, I was in Michigan. I just got to America, so I wasn't working. And then COVID hit, and I was like, well, I obviously can't get a job now for the foreseeable. Think back, we didn't quite know what was going to happen. So I thought, well, I'll start writing it in earnest a bit more. And I think that's when I started writing a book. Ended up on Substack. So it was kind of people were vaguely kind of aware that I was working on it, and kind of able to see my progress through the Substack, which is quite new at the time. I think that was quite effective that it was new for people to get that in their inbox. And that turned into a book and it kind of made some money. So I was able to kind of justify doing another one, which I did with Rob Tyre called Requina Syndrome. And then, it's kind of gone from there. And I'm able to keep kind of selling enough to kind of keep doing it, if you see what I mean. Now we have a family. That's obviously an important part of it. When it first started, I had all the free time in the world and I could just spend my weekends doing it. And now it's kind of turned into a actually quite a convenient sort of job. Because I've been a full-time dad or whatever the term of art is now, what stay-at-home parent, I don't know how people say it these days, since our eldest was born 2.5 years ago. But this has allowed the kind of flexibility. So at nap times or early in the morning, you can work on that while also looking after kids. But that's that.
So there must be a fair amount of discipline in that, not a whole swathe of time to look out the window and rewrite and ponder.
I mean, it gets easier to work now that I've had kids because the time feels at a premium. So the procrastination that I used to do, I basically don't procrastinate anymore. Because if I have time, it's like, oh, goodness me, I need to use this because I don't know what will happen tomorrow. They might not nap and I won't get anything. So actually, I work more effectively now with the time I have. But yeah, it's not ideal to kind of have to find these little snatches of time.
No, but it's interesting, and I think I've heard you say that before on a different podcast, because you sort of have this romantic image of a writer, maybe more associated with a fiction writer, wandering the hills searching for inspiration and then gnashing their teeth when they can't get it right. And actually, have you, on that note, have you ever written fiction?
No. I read almost all fiction, but I've never written a word of fiction. That would feel really weird.
Would it? So you see it as a
Oh, for sure.
totally separate skill set, the kind of writing that you do.
Because I read good fiction. And then if I wrote 2 words of it, it would feel so cringe-inducing. Do you know what I mean? Like it would be so bad. It would be awful. I couldn't bear to read it.
I know what you mean. I read almost exclusively fiction as well. Yeah, there's nothing like reading somebody who's amazing at something to make you not even want to start.
Do you write, I mean, fiction, any fiction? Is
I'm
that
ashamed to
something?
admit I do dabble. Yes.
And so is it poetry or
No.
stories?
No, it's prose and it's in various forms. And I'm just discovering recently, actually, that one thing I really, really love is telling stories. And that probably my skill set is more in the interpretation for others than the creation of anything brilliant. I'm not sure a brilliant novel is ever going to come out of me, but if I can write things that are good enough and then instill enough feeling within them when I deliver them, I think that's what gives me pleasure.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I think that I've
But
never, it's funny you ask me that, like I've never even considered it. I probably should. I'd probably enjoy it. Like I say, fiction's a big part of my life, but I feel like it's for better minds than mine to try and write fiction. Nonfiction is much more forgiving, you know.
would it feel more exposing to write fiction?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And does you said, or we both agreed about the being intimidated by good writers.
Yeah.
Does that mean that there was less material out there to intimidate you in the physiotherapy
Oh
literature?
yeah, it's all terrible. That's why
That
it's awful,
helps.
isn't it? Yeah. That's it. That's why, like, even if I was a doctor or something, as you know, there's a lot of doctors write like really wow, really good stuff. And that would be intimidating. But for whatever reason, I think there's something to do with physios. Probably the people who are your listeners, this will not describe, but I think of being in physio school or an office full of physios, mostly they get there because they're active and they're sporty. And obviously that doesn't mean you can't also be a reader and a writer, but there's only so much time in the day. And I think maybe to anger people with stereotypes a bit more, possibly people choose physio over, say, medicine or nursing, because they actually want to get away from writing essays and desks and sitting at desks. That's, I think, one reason I feel quite comfortable writing for in this space, is because there have been some truly great writers who are clinicians, of course. And actually, especially when you go back a few decades, it was so much better. But there's kind of like it's kind of the ground of writing space has kind of been spoiled, I think, by academic writing a lot.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there's a formalism to academic writing, which is obviously there for a reason. So it's a scientific method, and you have to kind of adhere to certain standards, and journals expect certain standards. So you have to open your article with back pain is the most prevalent cause of disability worldwide, and and you have to write in a certain style, and if you don't, then the journal will tell you have to. And which is my experience. I wrote only one piece of peer-reviewed research, and I was saying I'm going to make this different. It's going to be readable, and it wasn't in the end, because you have to adhere to so many standards. Like, if you report, what does the study say? You can't just say in plain language, because you have to be more precise about what does a p-value actually mean. So you find yourself saying stuff like, did not find evidence to support such and such, and which is not a lovely phrase at all.
No.
But I think that kind of dominates the style, is the academic writing. Whereas if you go back to some of the old papers in spinal care, but I presume in like other stuff, this frankly lower academic standards, then it's obviously just some guy who's been given some money or some time to open up some cadavers, and he describes what he sees, but it's fantastic. And there's a reason we don't do research like that anymore. But I think for people, even when they're not writing in for an academic journal, they still have that training or that shadow hanging over them of this is how you should write about this kind of stuff. So you see blog posts that start off with the shoulder joint, it's a ball and socket joint. Oh God, stop. Why? You're not helping yourself with
There,
that.
it's an academic.
Yeah.
So you say you understand why those standards are in. Can you explain to me why?
Well, do you mean why are journals written badly, or why are they not much fun to
Or
read?
why is there so much, why is it so definite that you must have those phrases and you must say the things in that way? What's it achieving?
I think, I don't know if you maybe say there's good and bad reasons. I think the good reason is are that you need to be precise when you describe things, and precision is particularly hard. And you need to be precise about, and you need to be very careful about not making assumptions, for example, when you write for an academic purpose. So I think that ends up people kind of tie themselves in knots a little bit for good reasons, because they want to be absolutely clear what they are saying and what they aren't. And then I think some reasons are bad, and I don't know culturally why, but obviously there's a convention that you have to write more formally and use longer words, and often longer sentences when you're writing for an academic audience, or people feel like that's the proper way to write. And I think there's possibly I don't know why that is, but it's not particularly helpful. I think as well as like a thing where even going back further, most people's experience of writing is writing for a teacher. And that's probably like if you brought together most words that people have written in their lifetime, it's either a shopping list or it's writing for a teacher, which is a really artificial experience because you probably don't care too much about what you're writing. The teacher certainly doesn't care really. And they're not reading you to learn anything. No teacher in middle school or high school expects to learn anything from their students' writing. So it's a really artificial, strange experience. And you're just trying to get the grade and they're just trying to work out what grade to give you. So I think that's people are kind of funneled through that way, that le they learn how to write like that. And that's how you get stuff like low back pain is a leading cause of disability worldwide. Introductions. And so I think a lot of learning how to write for people who actually want to read it, and especially if they want to pay for it, is unlearning that. And maybe because people know how to talk to each other, for example, like so many people write better, talk better than they write. And people can explain things really well. And then if you ask them to write it, they struggle. And obviously there's some obviously concrete reasons for that. Some people are dyslexic or they're just not used to doing it or crafting a sentence. But so often it's actually because they go into like writing for the teacher mode and they're imagining the teacher with the red pen.
I've never thought of it like that, that writing for a teacher or a teacher never expects to learn from their pupil. But I suppose the counter to that is that a teacher might occasionally be entertained by their pupil's writing. And you just reminded me of an experience I had at uni. So we had to write a certain number of essays per term. I can't remember why. And I kept getting Bs and B minuses and B pluses occasionally for my essays, which obviously I'm a perfectionist like all physios, so that was terrible. And thinking, why am I not getting A's? And took the slightly risky strategy in my third year of not referencing anything, hardly reading anything at all, reading a bit, deciding what my opinion was, and then delivering it. Which, if I'd pursued that into an academic career, I appreciate I would have come unstuck fairly quickly. But I got all A's consistently for all of those essays. And they definitely were not good academic essays. And the only thing I could conclude is that the poor tutor had 29 other essays that looked very similar, and this one probably was refreshingly different. And so I probably just hit the right tutor as well to deliver that to. But there's two things actually. That I'm thinking as well on this. I happen to have coached quite a lot of clinical researchers, physiotherapists who are clinical researchers, and they, one of the reasons actually they're often coming for coaching is the discomfort they feel in the academic world. I mean, I think I didn't really understand what a clinical researcher was, but I understand now what a difficult position that is to be in, where you're really stuck in that middle ground of trying to fit into an academic world which feels quite alien, and there are lots of rules to learn about not just how you write, but how you behave and how you talk to each other. And they're also still sitting in that clinical world where they're hyper aware of what it's like to try and translate that research. And they've chosen that role because there are people that want to see research getting translated. But, when I hear you talking, it just brings home how unhelpful that barrier can be. If non-academic people are just switching off and at worst case not reading it, and maybe at best just thinking, well, yes, but how does that actually, does that mean anything to me? And the other thing that was in my mind when you were talking was the MSK mag, and I know you've written as I have for that. And Jack is always very clear that this isn't an academic paper, and he gives us instructions as writers, doesn't he, to approach it in that way, and that he specifically doesn't want that language. Which, I
I
mean,
wrote those instructions, yeah.
yeah, and I
Right, yeah.
mean, is that refreshing for you, or do you find it a bit unnerving to write that way, or?
I think it do you need to write in a more casual style? I think it's well, it's certainly refreshing. I think that it's it's hard. It's really difficult for me to write. And because like I said earlier, I know I'm not a good writer. Like I read good writers and I know I'm not that, but I'm good enough for sure for doing what I'm trying to do. And I find it really difficult to write stuff. Like, and again, I think this is a thing of you have to read a lot, or have read a lot, because that's how you develop your taste. So you read your own stuff and you either you cringe internally or it feels wrinkly and you need to iron it out. So you have to read a lot to develop your taste. And so when I read my stuff, I never really enjoy it, and I have to kind of work so hard. And the style is often really breezy, and like an email might be like, "Hey, I was just doing this," but actually, no, I've worked really hard on that. It's like a
Really?
phrase. There's some phrase out there: a good writer is someone who finds writing more difficult than other people, because it feels like hard work, and you kind of recognize that actually it doesn't, unless you are, Tolstoy is actually that's a bad example, but unless you are something like Jane Austen, it doesn't come naturally. I think the other thing is that, when it comes, you say like write casually, and I think people, there's so many different ways to do that, and traps people fall into with that as well. Because you can also tell when someone is deliberately writing casually. Like so I don't know if that's the best word for it. And what I try to do is, so there's different kind of attitudes to it. You try and be like, some people talk about like classic style, which is that kind of old style, plain speaking, but also fairly formal and elegant. It might be a better target than something casual, where you can tell when someone's trying to be pally and matey with you and just put in swear words and like overwrought metaphors and stuff like that. Yeah, it is difficult, and I think it's freeing to not have to like adhere to a certain style, but there's so many, it's like quite a tightrope personally to walk. And there's still things that I read where, like in the books, where I write, that was too casual. Like it's a nice gag or a nice aside, but it doesn't feel like it should be in a book, and people should be reading that 10 years later, and I got that wrong. So it is tough.
Would that come under the killing your darlings heading?
I suppose so, I mean, I don't know. That's Kurt Vonnegut. Does that means like you got to edit aggressively? Is that what that means? That even the stuff you're fond of, you've got to just get rid of it if it's not doing the job? Is that what that
Yeah,
means?
so my understanding is your darlings are the things you absolutely love and you really, really want them in there. But when you read them, you're right, they somehow jar, they're serving you, but they're not serving the purpose that you're writing for. And yeah, they're the last thing you want to take out, but you sometimes have to.
Sometimes I do that. I leave them in because I also kind of think, in a way, I'm not actually doing, you don't want it to be too utilitarian. And I think hopefully what people like about what I'm doing is that they can sense that there's some passion. So if I'm talking about something that seems like an aside, I often do think you should take this out. And then I second guess myself and say, well, if you're interested, hopefully the people who really like your stuff are also interested,
Yes,
and if
yeah, I mean
not,
that's
they'll
the
forgive you. Sorry.
no, they'll forgive you for leaving it in. Yeah, and I think that's the flip side, isn't it? That are you taking out your darling because actually it's exposing some very true part of you? And sometimes that can be confronting to let people see that. It's one of the I think one of the interesting conversations around AI at the moment is what to leave in or what to put back in. And I know people have all sorts of varying opinions about AI at the moment, but I did hear someone just on a call yesterday actually say that the people that use it well will be the ones that put back in the phrases which are perhaps a bit quirky, perhaps not grammatically brilliant, but when you hear them, you will know that that was Tom Jessen that said that. There'll be no, it won't sound, I don't know, deliberately provocative or deliberately, like you say, trying to be matey or anything. You're just like, yeah, that's how Tom speaks. And to, whether you or not you choose to use AI, that I think it would be a great shame if we lose that part of writing in non-fiction or fiction. It's funny, actually, Tom, you bring up Tolstoy. I was listening to, I can't remember whose podcast it was, but she was interviewing this lady that had just written a book about lots of women throughout history, and it was basically voices that had never been heard, and one of them was Tolstoy's wife. And I don't know where she got this material from, but it was her actual speaking, and it was all about living with the genius in
He was
inverted
terrible.
commas. Yeah,
He was
and you had
awful.
12 kids and didn't do anything to look after them. Yeah.
She gave her whole life for him. I
Yeah.
don't think, I think she resents.
Yeah, what I loved was it sounded so modern because she was really, you could tell she was
Okay.
really pissed off with him.
Yeah, she was mad as hell, as I remember.
Yeah, so even if the writing did come easily to him, well, I'm not sure it did. It sounds like the pain was transferred.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, for sure.
So just changing direction a bit. With writing, as you know, I know it's not a full-time job because of being a dad, but the full-timeness of the, when you are working, that you're writing at the moment rather than being a physio, is it fulfilling a part of you that physio didn't?
Oh yeah, I think so. I definitely, it's something that you can do, and you can take sort of total control over it. And if it's bad, it's completely your fault. Whereas with physiotherapy, you have, you're hopefully going to kind of vaguely move some lever in this whole system of your patient's life and problems,
Even if by random
and
chance.
you, yeah. Like maybe you'll say the right thing and they'll go, oh, okay. Or maybe a certain exercise will help. But so kind of one of the frustrating things for that is, you could put it negatively or positively, but the negative way is, if you to be a physiotherapist, you need to, if you don't like that, then maybe you're a control freak or something and you can't accept the uncertainty. But at the end of the day, it is nice to have something like this blank page. If what's on this page at the end of this is no good, then it's completely my fault. And if it's good, and the quality of the work is proportionate to how hard you work on it. So it's all under your control. And at the end of the day, that feels nice. And in many ways, physiotherapy is probably as far in the other direction as you can get, where, you can work unbelievably hard. You can focus all day, really try and do your job wonderfully well. But at the end of the day, when that patient leaves, it's completely up to them what happens. And whether or not your patients get better is, I don't know what the right way to express it, and the percentages isn't right, but what, 20% up to you or whatever. And so that's kind of, there's a certain, like, if the word you asked was like fulfillment, like there's a certain aspect to me where that wasn't that fulfilling. And also just like I like this. I like sitting at the desk. I like reading. I like writing. It's just feels, it's kind of normal to me. I like being a physio a lot, actually. I loved it as well,
Do
but
you think
there's
you'll go back?
certain. If I was, I'd love to. It's if I don't, it'll be because of circumstances, kind of rather than choice. So the I love being a physio. When I worked in England, I was kind of, I always say, like bog standard physio in a GP practice. It's a bit of everything, as it is in the NHS, which I think people maybe don't realize or appreciate compared to America. You do get a fair amount of autonomy. You can practice how you want. You're often seeing patients for the first time, and if not, you can kind of direct treatment and as you see fit. So you have that autonomy, and then the scope of practice is a little bit wider as well if you want, in terms of like imaging and so on. Whereas in the States, I think it is still a bit more of an auxiliary profession to medicine. Not exclusively, but that kind of turns me off a little bit, to be honest. It is, and also, as you know, like the practice style here is so different, and not exclusively, but there's a lot more of the kind of manual things and a lot more of the you have five patients on a treadmill at a time type of thing.
Right, okay.
And then all the things to do with insurance and medicine and things. So and then there's also like life factors, like if we have another kid and all that stuff. But basically, the short answer to that, Joe, is I plan to, and I'd love to, and I'll have to make it work on my own terms,
Yeah.
whether that means going private or finding the right place to work. But also, kind of realistically, I'm thinking, well, if we, for example, have more children, or what will happen, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can see how you've got proofs that the writing can flex around life. And I know physio can as well, but yeah, I guess maybe not having practiced in the country you're in, that and with the things you've just highlighted. The other thing I was thinking when you were talking about writing versus physio is when you have something tangible, like you've got a book or two books, for better or for worse, that is there forever. Whereas as a physio, you're only as good as your last treatment, aren't you? And even if you've just been the best physio that ever lived in the last 30 minutes, that won't be remembered. It's nothing you can hold on to. I mean, okay, people write you testimonials and over time you get that reputation, but yeah, the book feels a more tangible bit of evidence, if you like, I suppose.
Yeah, it does. It's nice. It feels like you're working on something, and you can, I suppose I don't really at the moment, but one, I do have a sense that I'm building a collection or body of work,
Yeah.
a pretentious way of putting it, but like there's something there that I'm building,
Oh, you definitely
which is
are.
nice. And then being a physio is a bit more like memento or something, like everything just kind of wiped clean.
Yeah.
When that patient's discharged, there's also that sense.
Yes. And I wonder, you're obviously someone who, hope is not rude to say, seems to like geeking out on things and really drilling down into the detail. And I can see pros and cons. If you when you are a inverted commas bog standard physio, there's much less opportunity for that, isn't there? But I'm also right at the beginning when you were talking about how you first got into writing and how with the chordal equina and versus referred pain, or if not chordal equina, referred versus radicular pain, all that terminology. And then you said quite rightly that we kind of get by, not just in physio, but in life, knowing a bit about a lot of things. I'm just thinking, gosh, so if I had done what Tom had done and I'd kind of gone for an area and I'd become really expert in it, would that just make me feel how shit I was at everything else? And worry that if I don't know that level of detail for everything, then I don't know, I'm somehow lacking.
I mean, I'm not just saying this, but obviously no. But that's one of the kind of it's kind of a recurring theme. It's like, how much do you need to know about anything? And so from one side, people would say, our job is to keep it simple. We have a certain amount of time with patients. They have a certain bandwidth for understanding what we're trying to tell them. But also, even with everything you can know, many of it isn't directly applicable in clinic. What does it really matter if you don't know probably 90% of what I've written? And actually, I have a lot of. That's probably the side I would really gravitate towards. I think, the kind of keep it simple, within reason, keep it simple and focus on the big stuff, is, and not major in the minors, not get distracted by this little study or this anatomical fact. Stick to some key principles. I think that's probably the way forward, and that's like how I would practice.
I think you're doing a brilliant job with that, because I know as well as your books, you've got your little booklets or zines, I think you call them. And there's a couple kicking around my clinic all the time. And I think they're presented in such a digestible way. And I think you've been really clever in the way you've presented those, because it almost is presented in a way that wouldn't make you beat yourself up. It's slightly sort of and lighthearted is not the right word, but it's certainly not, it's not po-faced, and you sort of pick it up and you don't feel bad about needing to go and check up on that. And that's something about the presentation style, I think.
I mean, yeah, they're just, yeah, they're fun. They're interesting. It's a bit different. But yeah, I generally, that's kind of one of my concerns. It's like I go so much into this stuff, and one of, in a way, I don't feel the need to justify it. Like I think that it's just interesting, and I know that there's a lot of people who are interested in science, and they're interested too. But in another way, you know, I do kind of think that there needs to be one or two people who do go into all that stuff and then simplify it. And I always think of it as like simplicity has to be on the other side of complexity. It's really actually quite clear when people try to simplify something when they don't actually know the details. It always feels very complicated. And so I hopefully kind of, yeah, I do go too much into it from a certain respect, but I hope that it's kind of, you have to, I think of it as like third stage simplicity. You have this like, you start off with a simplistic understanding of something from a textbook. You go into all the complications, and then you recraft as a third stage another simplistic understanding. And often it actually looks very similar to what you started with. But hopefully, at least needs to be some people in the world who've been through that process to keep us on track.
Yes, I agree. And I think you might describe that final product, that simplified product, as absolute mastery, which has, I guess, it's taken care of all the hurdles that we've talked about, you know, that clunky academic language and the reams of stuff which your average person isn't going to read through, but it's the person who is able to take that and then really use it logically and present it well in a way that you do know that there's an awful lot more they know, but it's being presented in such a masterful way. I think I agree with you. If the complexity and the clunkiness and the irritating bits weren't there, you couldn't get to that mastery state. So we've heard in this conversation that you are clinician and writer and clinician and dad. Are there any other ands in your life that you'd be happy to share?
No, I don't think
Okay,
so.
that's
As
the
husband, yeah. So
end
that's no. I
I know
don't
you're
think
a
I have
tennis player because you
anyone.
talked about it last time on
Yeah,
your
I mean,
podcast.
there's, yeah, I play tennis and work out and all the normal things people do.
What's your favorite tennis shot?
If you give me like a cross court backhand, like it's coming at me cross court, and I'm in the zone, I mean, I'm confident. Yeah, that's gonna come
Bond.
back.
You're my person. We've just bonded over the cross court backhand.
Yeah.
Best feeling in the world.
I don't know why, but like if you step into it, I'm right-handed, you step into it with your right foot, and then you can just then get the whole backswing. That works quite well. But then I haven't played tennis for like a year now or two.
Oh, you need to get out there. I wrote a whole blog on the feeling when you hit a cross-court backhand and
Really?
how I've got essentially politely ejected from junior tennis leagues for not actually caring that much whether I won or not. And my whole blog is about winning for me was that contact point on the cross-court backhand. And that wasn't enough for my coach, but it was enough for me.
Really? That's so nice. But what about what's wrong with the forehand, Joe? What's
Oh,
your
the weight.
this against
So
the forehands?
this, I best geek out on tennis though. So I was taught in the year of the double hander backhand, and that's what I still do. So for me, that's a whole body experience. You know, being in the double hander makes you turn your body much more, and then you get to bring the whole of yourself into that backhand. So the forehand, there's way too much uncontrolled space with my right arm floating around all over the place. And my brain gets too involved, and there's just too much choice.
That's sort of how I feel as well. Yeah, I think so. Like it takes a lot longer for the forehand to warm up, and it's much more self-conscious, and the top spin will take it into the net for like 10 minutes until I get it in, because it'll be too much. And whereas the backhand, you just step in and just, if you don't think about it, it's actually better.
And it's better if it comes at you hard, isn't it? So you just have to absorb the power in that.
Wow. You see, we have like, it's not really a, do you have them in England? It's public tennis walls. You have them here in.
Well, We don't routinely, but as a kid, that was my f there was one at the tennis club I went to, and that was my favorite thing in the world, just to hit against the wall. Because it comes back hot, doesn't it?
It does, and it always comes back, and yeah, it's great. I have to get up to the tennis court again. It's been a little while.
Yeah, you need to get back out there.
Oh well. But everyone's playing pickleball now, you see. Everyone's on the court playing.
Pickleball, paddleball, is it the same thing? Everyone's talking about both here.
Everyone's pickling. You go for a walk at, like past the park, and you can just hear there's like people playing pickleball.
So someone was, I haven't played either, but someone was saying to me last weekend, oh, we don't want pickleball to take over because are they taking over tennis courts and halving them or something?
If I still played tennis, I would be really angry at them, I think. Because it's annoying enough when you go to the tennis court and there's someone there, but if they're playing tennis, you can't really complain. But if they're a grown adult, perfectly capable of playing tennis, they're not an old person, you know, and yet they're choosing to play pickle on the tennis court. I think I would be really annoyed about that.
Well, I think it's much bigger in America. It's Brené Brown's fault because she plays it and she talks about it all the time. That's what happened. My other great annoyance, my biggest beef in the tennis thing is swing ball. So swing ball was my favorite thing as a kid. And my mum says the soundtrack to my childhood is just dum 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 on the swing ball. But that was in the 80s, early 90s. And swing ball then was this really solid heavy metal thing that you had to put in with a mallet. You could kill someone with the spike on the end of it. The rackets weighed about a ton each. But it was a really solid thing and you had to get good at it. Whereas ever since, I bought my kids swing ball thinking, this is it, their childhood's going to be like mine. And it's this flimsy plastic thing that if you hit it harder than a little touch, it flies out of there. Well, it's usually a water-based thing anyway, so it rocks around all over the place. And the whole experience was just not swing ball. And I'm
No,
quite
I
angry
can well
about it.
understand that. Yeah, I can well understand that. Everything for kids these days is plastic tap anyway. Half our house is plastic. Poor kids. And yeah, that sounds some at some point someone's decided that they can't make the metal anymore.
It was probably a health and safety. It was very dangerous. I'm sure a lot of A&E visits were swing ball related, but it was fun. Tom, is there anything else you'd like to say about writing, about tennis, about being a dad, about America?
Just that I don't know. I hope is there anything else you want to hear? I don't really know what your audience exactly wants, and I suppose you don't either, but being a dad is a whole other thing, isn't it? That's a podcast in itself, I suppose. That's a spin-off is physios, parent physios, but that's pretty great.
You could share the story of the chunks before
That's
he
why I'm late
came.
for the, that's why I'm late. I was 15 minutes late because baby Evie threw up all over the parking lot at school. Bless her. She's still just about young enough to randomly throw up. So that's the story.
Yeah, no, and Tom sent me this very brief message of a sweating emoji saying 3:45 question mark. It was at 3:30, and I just had this inkling that it was the brevity of it and the sweating. I thought that's definitely a child incident. So the vomiting story was not a surprise. Okay, so final question. When we read a children's bedtime story for everyone, what one shall we read? What was your favorite?
My favorite, what are we doing at the moment? This, like I'm pausing because I need to get this right. Like, this is really important, isn't it?
Okay.
Actually, is
Go
when you
and
talk
get it
about
if you want.
that kind of thing. I would, but we actually brought it into school just today.
Okay.
Hannah wanted to take it to school to show one of her teachers, and it's called A Frog He Would a Wooing Go.
Say that again.
A frog he would a wooing go. Woo as in
Frog, he
woo.
would a wooing go.
Now, this is a very old, like traditional English rhyme. And the book is illustrated, it's like print plate print illustrations from goodness knows when, like they look sort of Victorian. So this is like really old stuff. And there's a tune that goes with it. And it is you need to know the tune, else because if you just read it sounds kind of mad and strange. But if you have the tune, I'm not going to do it. I almost did it actually, but then I was thinking right at the end of the podcast, I could probably get away with it. But if you look it up on YouTube, you'll get loads of actually cocomelonized versions, which you don't want to watch. Maybe I should record my own version, but
I was going to say, can we have that as an additional, if you do that, and I'll read a bedtime story as well. We could put that as additional material, which will be the only bit anyone listens to.
no. Because I've seriously thought about putting this up on YouTube because there's no accurate versions of the tune. I'm waving my finger at people who aren't watching. There's no accurate version of the tune. This is from my grandmother. I know this. And but that's a lovely book, A Frog He Would a Wooing Go. And the illustrations are wonderful. And because it's old, it's kind of dark at the end, like he gets eaten by a duck, which is like how all the old stories are. Like he would
Always
get set on
something
fire or
dreadful.
lose a limb or something. And these cats all chase them and stuff. So it's a little bit dark and scary in a kind of a good way. It's completely absurd and silly. It's got look, the language is beautiful. And yeah, if you're listening long enough, maybe you trust my recommendation. And if anyone's listening and they want, I'll send them like a voice recording of how the tune goes, which is very important.
There's an offer. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with that challenge, Tom, to record that
Okay.
on YouTube. Thank you so much, Tom. I've really enjoyed it. I don't really care what the audience want. I think that was a great chat.
Good. I hope so. Yeah. And yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I enjoyed it too. It's nice to properly meet you because we were trying to work out if we'd ever actually spoken, and I don't think we have.
Only the third party contact I think we've had so far. No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Joe.
Oh, I love that conversation. I'm so grateful to Tom for humoring me with, in addition to the conversation about writing, all the stuff about tennis and swing ball, and particularly the bedtime stories. So, the most important piece of information to take away from this podcast is obviously that you need to go and listen or find the YouTube recording of A Frog Who Went A Wooing. In fact, hopefully, we'll try and pop this in the show notes. And let's hope that the next stage in Tom's career is reading slightly macabre bedtime stories. Because I think we need to, Tom and I were talking off air about how we need to keep some of this stuff. There's obviously a line. Some of the old stories are unnecessarily brutal, but yeah, I think. Why do we shy away from emotion in children's books these days? And do we not need to teach them a little bit to practice emotion? So that has nothing to do with the title of the podcast, but yeah, you know, I like a blind alley as well as a rabbit hole. So I hope you enjoyed that. I hope our voices weren't so soporific that you had a kip in the middle, or maybe I don't apologize for that at all, and kip was the best thing that you could do. And on that note, if you are a busy clinician, being all things to everybody all day, every day, and sometimes forgetting exactly what it is you need, like a nap, then try and remind yourself, try and give yourself the permission to actually follow through on those needs, because you matter.
Tired of stick people drawings stinking up your exercise programs? Do you wish you had an exercise prescription software that had hundreds of pictures, videos, fully customizable text, inbuilt virtual consultation software, and you could send it by email or WhatsApp? If that software existed, I bet you'd want a 3-month free trial, wouldn't you? Just go to rehabmypatient.com/physiomatters now.